Okay, so hello, welcome everybody. Thank you for staying. Post-show discussion, which is going to be short, sharp, and to the point. And we have Mark, Sean, Sarah, Nick, and Ivan. And there's somebody else, Irena, is it?
Irena,
which we'll maybe get onto in a minute. So, I was going to start off the discussion. Well, first of all, by saying thank you for such a fantastic show. Actually, since last June, I think it was, so it's been really interesting to see it developing and changing in lots of different ways, which kind of brings me to my first question. I'll sort of throw it out to Mark, but maybe anybody else who wants to join in can, which is, how much is it changing from night to night during this run here? Obviously, it's changed a lot since the Edinburgh run and other versions I've seen, but over the past, whatever it's been, last Wednesday or whatever, how's the relationship with the audience and the...
Tonight feels like we're just trying to stay on. It was extraordinary. Thank you. It settles when things are right. We try and keep them in. When things aren't quite right, we go on looking for stuff, and then things just happen. Like a hand coming on. or Sean giggling. or the other day the feet said something. It was a 14-year-old girl, and she said, "Yes, I love puppetry." And so she came on stage and took over.
From me.
And Sean went shopping. So it's sort of in that way, but it's, as a show, it's settling into the rut. We're getting used to it, really.
Yeah. I mean, it was obviously different tonight because we had the wonderful Jackie, who was interpreting, which I was interested in because that's adding another kind of layer of language. And to me, so much of the show is about language and languages of one sort or another. I don't know if any of you feel like saying anything about this kind of play on language and the multiplicity of languages that are in the piece of Gimran, in case anyone fancy saying anything. Sean's close to my home.
But I don't know. I mean, I've always been fascinated with... puppetry coming from a movement background, and just how it really stretches our imagination of our own movement. And I think all three pieces do that in a certain way. Like the puppet, I can't help but laugh sometimes because I'm so amazed that this thing is alive in my hands with your voice on the other side having a go at me. And then the simplicity of the second piece that gets rid of the whole language, or it challenges your language to come up with a story in the second piece, which is really amazing. And how universal this show is as well. And the end piece, you've got double layers of movement going on. You've got the actual filmic scene going on in front of you, and then you've got the amazing, beautiful choreographed piece.
Sean, I think you've left your critical faculties at home. You're just like a fan and a member of the
club. I think that's why I joined. They don't even know me. I think it deconstructs language into a much simpler form, which everyone can relate to. And it was really interesting having Jackie tonight as well, because she was saying just afterwards how it added to another layer of language and deconstruction, and how she was torn between watching the movement and trying to get the language as well.
And there's something really central. I mean, there's a new thing that's emerged this run, I think, which is this little bit about limitations of language. And one of the one and something there's one of an idea of whether the table is actually because the Moses story, I mean, we're still trying to find out what we've got, and I think that's one of the journey, we're on the same journey, I think. And something that's emerging is this idea of Moses, which is very much about what was written down and then lost in a way, and who wrote it and why it was written. So for example, and this is a thing we're trying to get into, I want to get into the show, I think the first bit is sort of growing. One of the sort of paradoxes of Moses is that he's supposed to have written Deuteronomy, or Deuteronomy is his three of his speeches, but at the end of it is his death. And there's sort of, in Jewish mysticism, there's an idea that it was either written by God, or that God dictated it to Moses, who wrote it weeping, and wrote his own. And so there's this little loop at the end of Moses, where he sort of, and he's buried by God in an unmarked grave. So he's sort of unfindable, unworshipable. And there's this sort of real central, there's a lot of paradox, some paradox ideas around Moses' death, which sort of we've come across by accident. We started really with a joke about Moses, but it started but it seems to have something to do with this idea of language and what you can and can't communicate and how you can and can't communicate an idea.
Okay, I
want
to turn this way now. Wanted to ask you, well, I'm interested also in the fact that this is obviously a very contemporary piece of theatre, but the tradition, the Samaritan tradition, is very kind of core to the piece, and you're sticking to that tradition very much, the sort of three-man operation, three-person operation, with the, you know, the headhunting, etc. I don't know if you want to say anything about how important that tradition is to you, or what you feel about preserving that tradition within a contemporary context.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've just sort of adopted it, really, and grown, I suppose, grown very fond of it. We're very committed to it because I think of the degree of sort of realism you can get with the movements and control, and we're sort of control freaks in some way. So I think we like to sort of be able to have as much control of the puppet as possible, which is you know, so we're less inclined to move towards, say, marionettes, which for us, you know, feel very much at the whim of gravity or something. You know, we sort of feel we can get the pace and energy into the puppet through this technique, and I think as we go on, we sort of revere it more and more in a way. I think we sort of, in a slightly blasé manner, said, "Oh yes, we're popularising Raku for contemporary English or British audience," you know, sort of slightly pompously. And then I think, you know, now the company is sort of 14 or 15 years old, I think we can claim a certain degree of truth that lies behind the statement that we have sort of started to realise it does take quite a long time to get to grips with the technique, and there's a very famous sort of anecdote that it takes 10 years to master the feet, and then another 10 years to move up I think it's the left hand in tradition of Iraqi, and then after another 10 years you can become a master of the head, you realise that maybe there is some truth in it.
Yeah, and it's the fact that you've been doing it for so long means that you can actually play with it in the way you do in the first part of the show, which obviously only works because you're
I think that's probably a departure. I don't know, to be honest. I have seen Bunraku, I think that they present a far more kind of stylized choreography, far more choreographed sequence of puppetry movements. Whereas I think we're very, we do enjoy playing and
Keeping it
alive.
Kind of playing
at
doing it more than the demonstrating of doing more.
Yeah,
that works because you can do it right. I think that's very obvious to say, but you know, that's That's why it's so funny, that when you kind of slip in and out of focus and you know, demonstrate the, you know, the three major techniques, it's the slipping in and out, doing it right and wrong, that makes it so funny. Definitely. And obviously, if that was just kind of near pastiche, it would be mildly amusing, but it's really, really funny because when it kind of comes back in, it comes back in so strongly, which is that lovely moment for the audience where it just suddenly hits, you know, really beautifully.
Right, yeah.
Really
nice. That's the interesting thing for me as well. I mean, going off from what Nick said, Ranaku is definitely an old tradition. I went over there and had a look at it for myself in Osaka. And this was a really exciting project for me, having worked briefly with these guys in workshops, and the fact that the puppet is a character that the first time I've seen, which is leaning more towards a stand-up in his own right, rather than a puppet, and that's really exciting, and a real joy to have connected with two other people actually like that. To be able to trust and improvise is quite exciting. I've never seen it before. I'm just saying that so you tell your friends that. So do tell your friends.
Yeah, he's had a really lovely relationship with the audience, which is much more, as you say, like stand-up or pantomime. You know, it's about finding the fourth wall and really connecting in. And that whole, well, it gets called postmodern, but it's the Dog to the Hills, you know, the thing of the play and the play on the play and the stepping out and the stepping out, the stepping out, stepping in again, you know, which is so exciting.
Yes, presented us with quite a few problems as well, actually, because we've done a lot of playing around and with the material, and the material sort of slightly divides into two halves of the stuff that's very out there, and then there's the stuff that's very, there is this kind of fourth wall-y, and it's quite difficult when you open up the relationship, and it would be with anything, you know, not so just the puppet, but then and then you suddenly find yourself doing a sequence for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Is slightly more focused, a little bit more inwardly. So the sort of challenge has been to try and make everything feel as if it's kind of slightly put out to the audience.
Maybe this is a good moment then to actually talk a little bit about the devising creation process, and maybe open it up to Ivan and Sarah. And I'm very interested in this role of the non-performing co-deviser. Mm. So, I don't know if you want to say something, Ivan, about your role in creating the piece and how, and also Mark, I think as the kind of director that's also performer, so you're obviously in an interesting relationship to work, but you've got people on the outside as well, so over to Ivan first, perhaps.
In rehearsals it's a sort of devising process, so we're all sort of inputting and getting things right, getting things wrong.
Can I just add, you're a puppeteer as well, I know that, but maybe...
I'm messing around with puppetry for about 10 years, so. But first time I've done Bunraku and worked with these guys. So in the rehearsal room we'd sort of swap around and I'd sort of go on the puppet and outside eye and help sort of put my two cents worth in, see where it landed. So there's quite an intensive improvising process where you really need someone outside reading what's going on, and vice versa. So it's very much a dialogue between improvising and trying to come up with an improvised script, I suppose, for the show. It's been really, really great to participate in.
Can I say something, Sarah, about the process?
I suppose what you get here is you have what's been really hard is you're trying to create a narrative, and then you've also got all this physical stuff that you can't sort of escape, so you've always got a puppet. And talking about lots of layers, he adds like another layer, so you have a narrative with a person, but then you have three extra people on stage and the person isn't real. And then you try and bring in an actual person, and then you try and work out what the relationship is between the puppet and an actual person, you know. So there's all these like extra things, so it's been a bit of a complicated process.
Good. Yeah. And that character's, having seen the piece before, that character character has changed quite a lot, really, where you are, literally, physically, where you're
yeah,
placed.
Every night, pretty much. It
does it change? Yeah, because before in when last time, oh, I don't know, when was the last time I saw the crowd? Came on and stood behind before. So you still change.
Yeah, very much.
And do they know what is that set, or do you just wait to see where she's going to turn up and go?
No, it's set. Maybe we should do that. Yeah.
A little bit of both.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very different having you come in and sort of standing in front so that we see your back.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I can put into words what's different. It's just that it's a really, really different image to you standing kind of behind the table facing out.
Mm. A lot of it's image-led, so we like find an image like that. That's really cool. how do we get that in somehow? It's probably not the best way.
I mean, this actually was one of the questions I was going to ask, is how much is, you know, how much of the work is image-led or design-led? And I suppose the obvious question is, what came first, the puppet or the table or the concept or the...
The very first thing, I mean, all three pieces sort of existed in some form before we started making the show. But the very first, I was thinking about this evening, the very first thing we did was, it was originally going to be Low Life 2, which is, we can't kind of start with these kind of really utilitarian titles. And I did a drawing of us all wearing polo necks and having cigarettes. And that was sort of the starting point.
Yeah,
and then there was an idea of the table, and it was sort of this idea of the Nouvelle Vague and what's it called, the sort of beat poetry and all that kind of thing, and then the idea of the so that was one really sort of crucial image. And the other really crucial image, I think, was the puppet standing on the corner of the table. Which was just, I still can't, it's just, you know, in a way, all of that part, all of the first part, is a way to put him on the corner. For sort of as long as possible. I just think it's, so those two images were very much sort of things that made us think, you know, sort of start. And then it sort of started to come together. Beckett then came into that because he sort of, he wore black polo necks, lived in France.
smoked and
yeah. So it all sort of, it's all in it. I mean, it's sort of image then leads to atmosphere, and then we spend a lot of time trying to unpick. It feels like we're unpicking what we've put there. And sort of trying to line it up into some kind of first of all something that people can follow, and then you start looking for something that it might mean or how to let it mean whatever it does mean in the most sort of pleasurable way.
And at what point, Nick, did puppet hero come into the equation, our main character?
Well, as Mark sort of said, that everything sort of had a life slightly before the show, and the puppet was the same. He was made for a production of 1984 that we did, and then we didn't use him. So he was sort of lying around the workshop, and we were commissioned by the Jewish Community Centre to do a piece for a Seder night that they running and so we picked him up and decided to cast him as Moses.
He was delighted, I'm sure.
He was delighted, yeah. He very pleased to be given the part, and we did 20 minutes with him, and that sort of kicked off his character. And gave him a staff originally to walk around with. And he looked very biblical. found his role. Which is sort of often what sort of happens, I think, is that the puppets get made for one thing and have sort of, you know, hopefully a reasonably successful life in that. But actually, sort of often their best material is yet to be found. When you start giving them a sort of strange voice or doing strange things with them, that's when they become most alive, I think. And you can draw out a really specific character for them.
I think our time is up, am I right? I'm sorry we can't open it up to the floor, but we've just been told by Soho Editions that we have another show coming in, so we can perhaps continue the conversation in the bar. But thank you very much for your attention.